What Alan took. This is what Alan packed himself. His gnarly gray razor covered in dried blue foam, a bottle of shaving cream, which he and his father shared, a single box of Irish Spring soap, a nearly full bottle of my Dove shampoo, which would have to do, a half-empty bottle of his father's Old Spice conditioner, which would probably be thrown out by a drill sergeant, a one-way airline ticket, a hotel confirmation number scrawled on the back of a Six Flags coupon, an unopened pair of white tube socks that my sister gave him for Christmas, a pair of black Nike running shoes, size 13, narrow, two seafoam-colored bath towels, 1,000 promises from his recruiter that the war was pretty much over and Alan would probably never even leave Missouri, my clear shower caddy that I kept under the sink. That's how Alan woke me up, by dumping its contents, my least-used makeup, all over the bathroom counter. He offered little by way of apology or greeting when I opened the bathroom door. The buzzing yellow globe lights made me smash my eyes shut so I couldn't see him, but I could hear him and smell him. He smelled strongly of sour mash and the fresh-cut grass-scented sweat that belonged to some teenage girl I suppose I'll never meet. Hey, Mom, where's my birth certificate? When I was able to open my eyes, I saw Alan had a fresh but badly executed buzz cut, presumably the handiwork of one of his crew. I nodded and stumbled towards the walk-in closet in the study. Here are the things that Alan almost forgot. A certified copy of his birth certificate, a calling card with A. Ferguson etched across the top in even block capitals. Two combination locks, unopened, his barely earned high school diploma, a bank envelope with $30 cash at the top of a neatly packed cardboard boot box. When I returned with the box, Alan was on his knees in his room, shoveling the contents of our bathroom into a red NASCAR duffel bag. His suitcase sat gaping on his twin bed. Did you remember to get your birth certificate notarized? I decided to let Alan look sheepish for a moment. For all I knew, it might be the last time he ever felt enough like my child to be apologetic to me. I savored his eyebrows frozen upward over his open mouth, the way his cool hazel eyes seemed to be studying his thick black lashes before I sat the boot box containing the certified copy beside him. He laughed through his nose, which was as good as thanks to me. I sat on the bed behind him and studied his new haircut. On second look, his friend had done a pretty good job, just one tiny nick over his left ear. I realized the unevenness I detected wasn't the work of the clippers, but Alan himself. His slightly unsymmetrical left side, the roll between his ears near the back, a Klingon-like cluster of knots near his crown, the landscape of a skull I hadn't seen since he was an infant. Alan joined me on the bed and started lacing a pair of caterpillar work boots he had taken to wearing religiously after he graduated high school in May. I brushed the top of his newly bare head, my fingers still prickled from his scalp long after I took my hand away. You know, I said to Alan, I think they would have been happy to do that for you once you got there. Alan smiled. Though it was that new smile he reserved for his father when he said that Alan would never get himself up at 5 to go jogging, or that Alan would never get used to eating mess hall SOS after pounding filet mignon every Sunday at Logan's. I hadn't quite deciphered the full meaning of that newly minted closed mouth grin. All I knew for certain was that Alan was being awfully patient with me right at that moment. Yeah, well, I wanted to do it myself, Alan explained. Right then, my husband's alarm went off. I knew it would wake him on the first ring. I knew he had laid his keys and his wallet by the bedside and hung a change of clothes on the shower rod in the bathroom. I knew he only had minutes before my husband would be standing in Alan's doorway, impatiently strangling his keys. Did you say goodbye to Grandma Ferguson? I asked Alan. Yeah, I went by this afternoon. She said it was a good thing I came by, he said, before shrugging his eyebrows and returning to his left bootlace. He raised his voice slightly and added my mother-in-law's recently acquired tremor. Lord knows I might not be here much longer. Good, I said with a nod. Alan froze before repeating my absent-minded reply. Good. And then we both laughed. I was right. I looked up to find Alan's father hovering in the doorway. With suitcase zippers whizzing in the background, my husband studied me, not in the tracksuit I had laid out the night before, but still in my magenta bathrobe and fuzzy socks. His gaze asked, what are you thinking? I was thinking of multiple missed exits and the countless circles we would take around the terminal. I was thinking of purpose-driven crowds and the constant roar of suitcase wheels. I was thinking of how I would have to simultaneously hug my son goodbye while he tried to balance his duffel bag and suitcase. I was thinking about the awkward ride we would have on the way home. My tears, which Alan's father would try to talk me out of, saying, though not really believing, there's nothing to cry about. They'll send him back in a week. I was thinking of all that when I closed my eyes, shook my head, and told my husband, I can't. These are the things that Alan left behind. Half-open drawers and empty hangers, a wrinkly, overwatered cactus he picked up 2 spring breaks ago in Mexico, a string of skull-shaped party lights that appeared one Halloween and remained tacked around his window all throughout high school, an application to Ohio State University stamped all over in Mountain Dew rings, a dried rose in a mason jar he wouldn't let me throw away but never bothered to tell me about either, 2-inch-long, freshly cut hairs that must have leapt from Alan's neck to my fingertips when I reached up to kiss him goodbye, a half-read copy of Leaves of Grass, which Alan said he couldn't put down in June, but complained he couldn't focus on when he started drilling with his recruiter in July. A half-empty bottle of Ritalin he stopped taking 2 weeks before his drug test. A wastebasket full of Marlboro menthol boxes and 5-hour energy vials, both habits he started a week after quitting Ritalin. 1 lone Hot Wheels Corvette that stayed hidden in his top desk drawer, save those unusual sulky days that Alan would lie on his bed, a silent phone glowing by his side, and run the little yellow rusty car over his palm, studying the spinning wheels. Those Saturdays, I could open his bedroom door and let the Hoover hiss and growl under the bed while Alan never once stirred. A proud and terrified mother weeping on his bed. A father dubious that a drill sergeant can accomplish what we and countless other school officials tried to do. A bedroom door my only child closed firmly behind him, and blinds that he left wide open.
Amanda, tell us about this story.
I think I started working on it in 2012, and it's one of those that I would write a little bit on and put it back in the drawer and pull it back out.
Is it inspired by real events or completely fiction?
Completely fiction. I will say the age I am, I'm 38. I had a lot of friends who did enlist during the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, but I mean, it's not really based on any particular person or thing.
Did you study writing formally at any point?
I'm studying writing right now. I'm getting my MFA in creative writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts.
So I guess you're writing a lot on a regular basis.
Oh gosh, yeah. I've been writing a lot.
And how about your favorite author, book, whatever inspires you?
Well, this one, I think people will see Tim O'Brien right away. What Southern girl doesn't love Flannery O'Connor? anyway, Kelly Link, Margaret Atwood.
All right. Thank you very much. Amanda Futrell.